KPFKI. This is an easy way to help support KPFK. Plus, it's a tax deductible, and we'll pick it up for free.
Hi, this is Lonnie Jordan from the band War, and you're listening to Southern California's people-powered radio, KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, and globally online at kpfk.org.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. We live in a global world. We are all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the relationship between art and politics. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. Today on Sojourner Truth, we talk with former Ambassador Desiree Cormier-Smith about the continued actions by the regime to impose its domestic attack on human rights and democracy onto the world. And we hear from movement leaders about making meaning of the invasion of the body snatchers in Minneapolis and across this country with a call to action. All this and more on Sojourner Truth Radio after this short music break. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. The Trump regime continues its global chaos making with the withdrawal from 66 international human rights institutions and organizations and the imposition of more restrictions on U.S. global grant making. The proverbial empire is certainly trying to strike back. Pleased to be joined by former Ambassador Desiree Cormier-Smith to break down what is happening with this withdrawal and why it matters at home and abroad. Desiree Cormier-Smith is the former representative for racial equity and justice with the U.S. State Department. Remember those days? Desiree Cormier-Smith is also the co-founder and principal of the Alliance for Diplomacy and Justice and a senior fellow at Harvard Kennedy School. Good morning, Desiree.
Good morning. How are you?
I am filled with the spirit of resistance. That's what I keep telling people.
Amen. I'm going to steal that.
Please do. Please do. Let that Henry Louis Gardet taught us to let resistance, your motto be resistance. So that's where we are.
Yes.
Let resistance be your motto. And plenty of resistance we have to do, even on the global level. Lots to talk about. Let us start with the United States continuing its withdrawal from the international spaces that are trying to heal and benefit the world. 66 organizations that the U.S. has decided that it is withdrawing from.
including the permanent forum for people of African descent, of which we both have been connected. And so wanted to talk about that. Let's, you know, what is happening? How is this, you know, what is the continuation that we're seeing here?
Yeah. Thanks for the question. So earlier this month, on January 7th, this administration announced it had conducted a review and decided that it was going to withdraw from 66 international organizations that it deemed were not in the interest of the United States. And to my surprise, they included the UN Permanent Forum on People of African Descent. I was surprised, not because I thought that this administration cared about Black people. I was surprised because this administration had not been engaging with the Permanent Forum on People of African Descent, nor was there any U.S. funding for the forum. So for them to include it explicitly in this list made me believe it was nothing more than a racist dog whistle, you know, to satisfy their base. That suspicion was confirmed by the fact that there was a New York Post article less than an hour that came out less than an hour after this announcement, talking specifically about the forum as a quote unquote racist forum for woke radicals that pushed the global agenda of reparations. So again, this was unnecessary, but we know that they do unnecessary things, because there was no dedicated U.S. funding to the Permanent Forum on People of African Descent. And it was a body, it is a body of the UN Human Rights Council, which the United States had already withdrawn from at the beginning of this administration. So it is not a surprising move by this administration, which again, we know is defined by its anti-Blackness. But I do hope that U.S. civil society and U.S. members of Congress, particularly the Congressional Black Caucus, will now engage in the forum even more robustly to fill that void and say, yes, this government, this administration may not care about the challenges impacting Black people in the United States and around the world, but we do, and we're going to still show up.
Yeah, I think it's going to be so important for Black folks from civil society, from the United States, to be at the fifth session of the Permanent Forum for People of African Descent, which is happening this April. I know that Baji will be there, but you know, yeah, it is really concerning. Yeah, we've been there since the beginning, since the first one, trying to make sure that we holler and scream for folks and get some strategize and get some stuff done. But it's, you know, firstly, usually there, you know, that's in Geneva, and then it also comes to New York, right?
Yeah.
Because UN is in New York. You know, clearly that's not going to be happening for a while. And so that means that if Black folks in civil society from the United States want to be able to go, folks are going to have to get, you know, tickets to fly. People are going to have to get hotel rooms. That Geneva is not a cheap place. It's quite expensive. And, you know, but so we're really going to have to be thinking about how we support each other, what we can do in order to be able to be there, because it's also, there's no virtual option. The first year there was a virtual option. And then I think the second year as well. And then after that, that ended. And so really people are going to have to be able to go there in this time. This is what, the 25th anniversary of the Durban Declaration. What does it mean to have situation in which you have so, you know, people from the United States, Black folks who have so many issues that they want to put on the table, along with siblings around the world. What does it mean that there's been this push by the regime, or this action by the regime, to cut the United States off, basically?
Yeah. And for them to use the crazy justification that, you know, somehow this was a radical form and that it's counter to U.S. interests, I think, is also very telling. You know, you mentioned that the first session of the forum there was a virtual option. I just want to say that that was because of a contribution from the United States. So I, at that time, was the U.S. Special Representative for Racial Equity and Justice at the State Department. And because of my team's efforts, we were able to find money to make a voluntary contribution to the launch of the form. And it was modest, but it allowed for them to make sure that the sessions of the form were virtual so that it could be accessible to folks who couldn't travel to Geneva. And we also were able to, they were also able to use that money to provide 13 travel scholarships for civil society from around the world. So even though I was never able to get a dedicated line item in the budget for the forum, I do want to acknowledge that we did strongly support the forum and we were the only member state to make a voluntary contribution to the launch that later kind of pushed other member states to make subsequent contributions. So this is really personal for me because I made sure while I was in the State Department that the U.S. always strongly supported the forum and always showed up and always used our power and influence to make more space for civil society. And while I would never say that the Trump administration should be engaging in this form because I don't think they would be engaging in good faith. So I'm not saying that them removing themselves from the form is not a good thing, but I do fear that them pulling out from the form in this way may mean that they may try to pressure other governments to pull out as well. We know that they are extremely well connected with other right-wing, anti-rights, authoritarian and authoritarian wannabe governments around the world. And it's important for those governments to be a part of the forum so that they can hear from communities of African descent from their country and around the world about the conditions facing us and their responsibility to promote our rights and protect our rights and respect our rights. And if this administration is going around bullying other governments to withdraw from the forum or withhold funding from the forum, that could be really detrimental.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, we see that the regime is trying to, like, create its own side UN that's controlled exactly. by him, you know, and so all of that fits, right? It would be definitely on brand for him to and for this regime to engage in that type of action. But it's not just looking at the UN and at these organizations then, including the Permanent Forum for People of African Descent. But also, of course, they're not happy unless they're also attacking the rights of people with respect to their reproductive rights. And exactly. So we see that we have this global gag rule that it's not like they started it, you know what I mean? But they clearly have expanded it. Share some, please, about that.
Yeah. So, like you said, they did not start the global gag rule, right? This was started by Reagan in 1984. And whenever there's a Republican president in the White House, it is expected that they will kind of enact this global gag rule. And it's called the global gag rule because it basically says that no foreign entity can use U.S. foreign assistance to provide abortion services. Okay. And again, that is the normal gag rule. This administration has expanded it to unprecedented levels in a couple of ways that I think this audience in particular should be aware of. One, it's not just foreign NGOs now. So they're not just saying, you know, if you are a foreign non-governmental organization and you want this U.S. grant, you cannot use this money to provide abortion services. They are now saying this applies to foreign non-government organizations, U.S. NGOs operating overseas, multilateral institutions like the United Nations and foreign government. They are also now saying that this applies to all foreign assistance that is non-military foreign assistance. So it's not just relegated to health. And they are now saying that you cannot use any of your money, even if you didn't get this money from the U.S. government, to provide abortion. And here's the other kicker. They are expanding it now to not just include abortion services. They're now also saying you can't provide any abortion services, nor can you promote, quote unquote, gender ideology, nor can you promote quote unquote discriminatory diversity, equity, and inclusion. This is unheard of. I mean, it's for an administration that loves to talk about state sovereignty, and this is why they're pulling out of the UN Human Rights Council and all these other organizations. This is a direct infringement on the sovereignty of other countries.
Absolutely, which they don't mind doing. We'll talk about some of that in a little bit, right? We're clear about that. But yes, absolutely. I mean, and it's just the imposition of this racist, authoritarian, fascist, Euro future. You know, we talk about like Afro future, like this is, and it seems, you know, when you say Afro future, you think about this, the creativity, you think about the abundance, you think about, you know, it's like, that's the world we want to be in.
Right.
But this is like the Euro future in their mind. You know, it's like Mad Max takes over the world, you know?
Right. Exactly.
And this, so it's like just desert. There's nothing good is happening. The earth has been destroyed. We're all, you know, people are killing each other for water. And it's all about like might makes right and who can destroy whom. And this is all a part of that, like really trying to impose that as a global world order, no?
That's right. And it's really, it shows their obsession with these domestic culture wars, their obsession with basically trying to make the US a white Christian, heterosexual, heteronormative nation, and applying that domestic culture wars to the world.
Right, absolutely. And it's interesting because they've been doing it undercover, right? Covertly.
Yeah.
It's like that part of the political spectrum, political world, right? So but even before the regime, we saw them doing that. That's why we saw all these anti-LGBTQ laws that were popular with these particular governments throughout the continent, right? That's why we saw, again, all of these attacks on not just abortion rights, but reproductive rights generally, even teaching sex ed. Yep. I was literally in at the African Bar Association. This had to have been 2-3 years ago, which was held in Malawi. And this woman, Sharon Slade, who folks can look up, has this, you know, very well-funded organization coming out of Utah, was there. And she has been not just going around the world, and particularly in the global South, pushing this culture war piece, but has invited leaders that include MPs, right, ministers of parliament, people that are in various administrations, to that ranch over in Utah so they can brainwash them even more. And she was there and she was complaining that, you know, 5-year-olds are being taught all kinds of sexual, graphic sexual information, and also attacked conversations about gender diversity, attack conversations about, you know, some of the soft life, or what is it, the wife that stays at home and
the trad wife. Yeah.
There you go, the trad wife. I mean, she literally was spewing that for at least 30 minutes. The African Bar Association, ma'am, this has nothing to do with the, like, why is this woman here? Right. And so that was already happening. And now these people are the people that are in charge,
that are in power. Exactly. So I think I'm so glad you mentioned that. This, you know, this right wing extreme Christian nationalist movement has been working to export their agenda, particularly their anti-trans and anti-LGBTQI plus agenda, for years. And they are incredibly well resourced. I was talking to some colleagues, some friends in Brazil, and they were talking about how white Christian nationalism is also a threat to their democracy. Right. And we don't even think about that. But these folks have been very intentional about the systematic export of this dangerous ideology. And now they are the ones who are making the policies and who are in charge. And that should terrify all of us.
Absolutely. As I said, let our motto be resistance. We've got to push back and keep pushing back. And speaking of resistance, the indigenous folks in Greenland have a you know, a message for this regime. They don't want it. They don't want to be a part of it. They don't want any piece of it. They're like, leave us alone.
Right. And, you know, y'all got your own problems. Deal with that.
And it is something when folks are like, you know what? I know we semi-autonomous and some of us maybe not want to be with these Danish people, but we prefer them. Literally.
Right.
Saying we prefer them. We would rather be with them than be bothered with you. And, you know, when I was thinking about it, I know, and, you know, Greenland has been a country that has been in the mouth of this president for a while, you know, not just in this part of the regime, but when he was there, you know, the first time. And I think in his mind, and in most people's minds, when they think of Greenland, because it's in Europe, there's an assumption that the people of Greenland are white people, because Europe is one of the only racially defined continents. Yes, I will say that on the planet. Like everyone else may have some natural barrier, you know, water, this, that, and the other. But with Europe, you know, it expands as they bring you into the world of whiteness. You know, countries that weren't Europe when my father was a kid are now Europe, right? Because mm-hmm. nothing changed about the geography. It's just they decided, yep, you can come in. And so there's this notion that Greenland is white. In fact, it is not majority white. And I think that that also plays into why this regime thinks it should be able to just go and get it.
That's right. That's right. So Greenland is about 90% indigenous, Inuit, or mixed Inuit. 90%. And, you know, I think that's exactly right. That's part of the reason why this president and the people around him don't give a damn about what the people of Greenland want, right? They don't give a damn about their right to self-determination. They just think they can take it over. And, you know, it's a semi-autonomous land, and they have not, you know, as any country with an indigenous population, they have had challenges with Denmark as well, right? There was actually just recently Denmark finally issued a formal apology to Greenlanders over forced sterilization of Greenlander women, of Inuit women, who were, unbeknownst to them, forcibly sterilized, as many of them as young girls, but in the 60s and the 70s. And many of those survivors are alive today. So, you know, Greenland, Denmark has not been perfect, but it's up to the people of Greenland to determine their own future. And as you noted, the overwhelming majority of them do not want to be colonized by the United States.
Yeah, I had told someone that I know, I said the two or three that may think they want to be colonized by the United States need to holler at Puerto Rico, you know, need to holler at the U.S. Virgin Islands.
And they're probably the 10% of the non-indigenous population.
Exactly. You know what I mean? To be clearer about what is going on here. Right. But I think that you know, your points are well taken. It is really important that we recognize that we have a people that already are in a situation of colonization. I mean, they describe it as being semi-autonomous. One person's semi-autonomous as another person's colonized. And all that means, right, every single time, about how families are separated, about how, you know, people are sterilized without their consent and have other things happen to them, right, without their consent.
That's right.
And it's, you know, for this regime in 2026, to continue to think that, you know, the expansion of empire is what needs to happen, and, you know, is at the same time being so critical of, you know, folks everywhere else. You know, I was telling someone before that had come on the show, it's like, you know, as we think about all of these people that folks are labeling dictators, and maybe even rightfully so, the United States, you know what I mean? Take out the 2x4 in your own eye before you start running around trying to talk about what other countries are doing. We've got to really understand what's happening right here. And that doesn't mean we don't care about other places, but it becomes increasingly difficult to even demonstrate that care if we don't handle what's happening right in front of us.
That's right.
Thank you so very much for coming on, for speaking with me. How do folks get in touch with you, or if they want to follow your work, because you are all over doing all kind of things, how do folks do that?
Well, thank you. And thank you as always for having me. I always enjoy talking to you. So I'm the co-president of the Alliance for Diplomacy and Justice. So I would encourage folks to visit our website. It's www.thealliancefordiplomacyandjustice.org. Check us out on LinkedIn, give us a follow, sign up for our newsletter if you feel so inclined and are able to. Feel free to make a donation. We're a C3, so it's tax deductible. And, you know, we are on the front lines of trying to force human rights to become a central pillar of U.S. foreign policy. And to be clear, it has never been a central pillar of U.S. foreign policy. And we all know that because all of us, all the 8 co-founders, all women, were former ambassadors or special representatives focused on human rights at the State Department. So we can say with great credibility that we know that our issues, and particularly for marginalized communities like Black folks around the world, have never been a priority. And so we are now trying to use this opportunity of we see all this destruction and darkness to imagine a better way to do this and imagine a better way to engage with the world, a way that, you know, promotes everyone's dignity and rights and humanity. And again, we've never done that. So it's going to take a lot of creative muscle to imagine that world, but we think it's possible.
That world is not only possible, it is right here at the tip of our fingers, tip of our fingers.
That's right.
Thank you so very much, Desiree. Really appreciate you. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
You too. Thank you.
That was former Ambassador Desiree Cormier Smith. The demand to stop taking our people and the call to break the ice machine after this station break.
Through the winter's ice and cold, down Nicolet Avenue, a city of flame fought fire and ice neath an occupier's boots. King Trump's private army from the DHS, guns belted to their coats, came to Minneapolis to enforce the law, or so their story goes. Against smoke and rubber bullets.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth with me, your host, Nana Jumphy. This week, a coalition of movement leaders, organizations, and networks from across the country, including the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, also known as BAJI, Advancement Project, Freedom for Immigrants, the Movement for Black Lives, Jewish Voices for Peace, and the Rising Majority, came together to launch a framework for making meaning of the invasions of our cities by ICE, Customs and Border Protection, federal agents, and masked mercenaries, and ended with a call to join in mass action together. Enthusiastic participants heard from me as executive director of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, Paige Ingram, a longtime Minneapolis organizer, straight from Minneapolis, and also a Movement for Black Lives lead. Lara Kiswani was the executive director of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, Adaku Onyenka Crawford from Advancement Project, who spoke about the strategic underpinnings of these attacks on our cities, on our communities, on our neighbors, on us, and what we need to do to stop them before it's too late.
Nana Jumphy, who is going to tell us a little bit about what STOP is as a framework and give us the context of how we got here. Over to you, Nana.
Thank you so very much. Woo! I'm so happy to see all these people here. So happy to see folks from across the country. Thank you, Erica, for getting us started here. I am Nana Jumthi. My pronouns are she, her, Wonu in the Cree language of Ghana. And I am the executive director of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. Glad to be here with you. For those folks who may not know about BAJI, BAJI is a Black national organization that fights for the rights of Black migrants and Black Americans through organizing, legal and policy advocacy, research and reports, civic engagement, and narrative building to improve the conditions of Black people and to advance racial justice and migrant rights. We are really excited today to be launching our Stop Taking Our People framework and our mass organizing experiment, as we're calling it, Break the Ice Machine. What is STOP? So folks have been seeing stuff about it here and there and trying to get a sense of what it is. Stop Taking Our People is a framework. It's a set of values. It's a warning and an invitation. It's a framework that helps us make meaning of what's going on right now. Why defunding is not enough. Why giving more funding is not enough. Why it's not about training and it's not about body cameras, right? So helping us to understand what it is that we're seeing and to make meaning of what it is we're seeing and experiencing. It's a set of values that requires us to acknowledge and thereby center the anti-Blackness that is at the roots of enforcement generally in this country, both the immigration enforcement and criminal law enforcement systems. It's a warning that continuing to dismiss the experiences of Black people, including, and in this case, especially Black immigrants, will lead to more confusion, more violence, more death. And we know we don't want that. And it's an invitation to shift how we understand and know what is going on with this regime. An invitation to look at the fact that this regime is using immigration enforcement to build a taxpayer-funded, authoritarian, racist, domestic army that it needs to control us all. The central premise of STOP is that immigration and the criminal law enforcement systems are really different parts of the same system, a machine that is powered by anti-Blackness and designed to control, to cage, to survey, and to disappear us all. And these recent invasions of the body snatchers, who are they? ICE, CBP, federal agents, and the mass mercenaries. That the invasion of the body snatchers that we're seeing all over the country are not about criminality. They're not about documentation. They're not about citizenship and are firmly about race. They are racist, authoritarian, run a test show that we must disrupt together. And we've got to do this now. Are we ready to do it now? Can we do that now? We must disrupt together and we must do it now. We're inviting you to join us in a mass organizing experiment that we call Break the Ice Machine. When these body snatchers come and invade, they're not local, right? They're coming from other places. And they don't teleport. We're not on Star Trek. They are coming in and they're not teleporting home. They are staying in those cities. And where are they staying? They're not sleeping on the sidewalks. They're not in the parks. They're staying at hotels. And so the hospitality pillar, and particularly the hotel pillar that holds up these invasions, is who we are going after. And we're asking you to join us in going after that together. And we're going after that by targeting one of the biggest of them all, a hotel chain that has made clear through its own words and actions that it supports these invasions, and that hotel chain is Hilton. And so we are boycotting Hilton, we are applying commercial pressure on Hilton, and we're calling for a nationwide boycott, thrilled with what we've seen already happening all over the country, including in Minnesota. But we're calling for a nationwide boycott of those big infrastructure pieces that hold, that have the ice machines, the hotels, and in this case, Hilton. Hilton has picked itself by its actions. The CEO of Hilton has said that the regime's economic policies, including the tax policies that are feeding him and his billionaire friends and are starving us and working class folks, that that is perfectly good with him. They've donated to the regime's electoral process. They've donated to the regime's inauguration. They've made it clear that they are best buddies. And we are making it clear that we will not patronize them. We will not fund them. We will not stay at those hotels as long as they do not publicly refuse to deny reservations to those body snatchers. Thank you so very much. Passing it back to you, Erica.
Thank you so much, Nana, for giving us that framing of stop and for telling us about the Break the Ice Machine campaign and experiment that we are about to embark on together. The way that we've been hearing immigration being talked about and how folks are going about targeting ICE, they're leaving out the criminalization of it all, right? They're talking about ICE and immigration as if it's not connected to a system of criminalization. And so it's important that before we embark on this experiment and move forward with our STOP framework, that we understand that. And so I'm going to pass it to my comrade, Adaku Onyeka Crawford from the Advancement Project, to kind of connect those dots for us.
Thank you, Erica. And I am really happy to be here for this important conversation and the launch of this campaign. So like Erica said, my name is Adaku Onyeka Crawford, and I'm an attorney and director of the Education Justice Program here at Advancement Project. And Advancement Project, for folks who may not know, is a multiracial civil rights organization that is working to fulfill America's promise of a caring, inclusive, and just democracy. Advancement Project, we use movement lawyering, narrative strategy, and campaign strategy to strengthen social movements and achieve high impact policy change. And so understanding and applying a racial justice lens is critical to that work, and also how we can understand the moment that we find ourselves in today. So we need to know that immigrant justice is a racial justice issue, and the way that ICE, CBP, and DHS is moving and terrorizing immigrant communities is consistent with the way that law enforcement and the criminal legal system has terrorized Black communities in this country. You see it in the over-reliance of surveillance and military tactics. You see it in the places that the Trump advance regime has targeted. These are cities with rich and vibrant Black and immigrant communities. And you even see it in the response from ICE in the aftermath of extrajudicial killings, and the way that they mirror responses to when we see police killings of unarmed Black folks. So first, you need to paint the victim as a criminal or an alien or a domestic terrorist. And then you exploit an unquestioning news media to run quotes that contradict video evidence and eyewitness accounts. And then finally, using the legal system to shirk accountability and deny justice for those victims and impacted communities. This is a system that grew out of slave catching and has persisted to dehumanize Black and other historically marginalized communities for centuries. The same system that justified the killings of Michael Brown, Eric Garner, Philando Castile, Breonna Taylor, Freddie Gray, and so many others is the same system that is justifying the ICE deaths of Keith Porter, Parity Law, Eber Sanchez Dominguez, Victor Manuel Diaz, Luis Beltran Yanez Cruz, Luis Gustavo Nunez Casares, Geraldo Lunas Campos, Rene Nicole Good and Alex Preddy, and so many others who have died in ICE custody. In 2025, ICE imprisoned 48,000 people without criminal convictions, including senior citizens, parents, children, teens, and other family members. And last year, 32 people died in ICE custody, all the while ICE denies requests to inspect the conditions of their facilities. This is not an issue, like Nana said, that more money, body cameras, or training can solve. It cannot be reformed. It cannot be fixed by simply removing a secretary or some other figurehead. ICE must be defunded and it must be abolished. Advancement Project has advocated for policies that abolish systems that criminalize, surveil, and seek to control Black and Brown communities. We fight to replace these systems with investments in liberation for communities that have been marginalized for too long. And one example of that work that I'm happy to be a part of is the National Campaign for Police-Free Schools, which Advancement Project co-convenes with the Alliance for Educational Justice. This is a campaign that recognizes that today, Black students are more likely to attend schools with police and surveillance mechanisms, but no school counselors or other basic supports. And that spells dangers not only for Black students, but also immigrant students and families. So grounded in this belief that removing police from schools is the seed to removing police from our communities, the campaign centers the leadership of young people and organizers who are using six strategies, which we call our six Ds, to advance abolitionist fights. So strategy one is decriminalizing schools by eliminating laws and policies that criminalize students. So for example, stop issuing citations for things like truancy to limit contact between youth and adult courts and immigrant students and families. Strategy two, deprioritize the role of school police officers so that police are not contact or are only contacted as a last resort. And this would limit school-based arrests and referrals to law enforcement and information sharing between law enforcement agencies that place students and families at risk of prison or deportation. Third, divest from policing and invest in student supports that create a welcoming and inclusive community, such as counselors, newcomer programs, access to mental health supports, engaging co-curricular and extracurricular options. Strategy four, demilitarize schools by removing weapons from school police officers, eliminating metal detectors and surveillance technologies, and disarming school staff. Strategy five, delegitimize false narratives perpetuated by law enforcement and ICE and defend immigrant students, prioritizing the voices of Black and immigrant students and families in conversations about safety, and publicly stating commitments to protect students regardless of race, ethnicity, national origin, or immigration status. And finally, dismantle relationship between school districts and police departments to shrink the scope and power of police, especially in places where police is working with immigration enforcement. So the fight for police-free schools is just one example of applying the STOP framework to marry racial justice, immigration justice, and educational justice, and abolish the school-to-prison-to-deportation pipeline. But the STOP framework can be applied broadly to achieve real public safety for our communities, particularly now as advocates are urging Congress to defund and abolish ICE and restore funding that was cut from healthcare, education, and other public benefit programs. So now is the time to see things clearly, change course, and act differently together. Thank you for your time. I will hand it back to you, Erica.
Thank you so much, Adaku. Just wanted to highlight, you know, whatever lines that once existed between cops and ICE or CBP, they've been dissolved, okay? They are all one in the same, two peas in a pod, and they are working together to make our life a living hell, if we're being honest, okay? And one city that we've been seeing that they've really gone in and have been terrorizing is the city of Minneapolis in the state of Minnesota, okay? And I really want to pass it off to my comrade Paige, who's gonna give us some on the ground reporting live for Minneapolis. What's going on, Paige? What y'all got going on over there?
Thank you, Erica. So I was asked to provide a summary about what's currently happening in Minnesota. Where does that summary even start? I would argue that it actually starts, let's say, about 10 and a half years ago with the killing of Jamar Clark, and fearless, incredible leaders of the then BLM Minneapolis chapter who occupied the 4th Police Precinct in Minneapolis for, I believe, 18 days in November. Maybe I would start it with the killing of Philando Castile just outside of St. Paul, blocks away from where I used to live. Maybe it starts with the killing of George Floyd in the summer of 2020. I guess what I'm trying to say is that this has been going on for a long time, that the reason why this incredible response is happening in Minneapolis is because of the tireless work of Black people across the diaspora of all backgrounds coming together, youth coming together, and advancing the work of this current iteration of the Black liberation movement. Airport shutdowns, occupations, risking getting shot by white supremacists, Mall of America shutdowns, etc. That is why we have the incredible systems in place, is because of that work. So what I can say about what's happening now and also about why Minnesota, it's about anti-Black racism. It's about the targeting and the scapegoating of the Somali community in particular, but the Black migrant community at large. Did you know that Minnesota has the largest population of Liberian migrants in the country? Yeah. Minnesota has been for years, since the 90s, a place where refugees from Africa, from Southeast Asia, and increasingly other places have gone. For a lot of people, Minnesota represents what a somewhat functioning welfare state looks like. But more importantly, I think that Minnesota represents what's possible when people come together across coalition, but also what it means for everyday people to decide that enough is enough and that we want to defend our neighbors. So Renee Good was part of a network that already existed of people who decide who've been trained up since at least last year, if not earlier, around community defense. And that work is being moved largely by white folks who are clear that it's important for them to be on that front line, as there are neighborhoods where every other house on a block has a black migrant family or a Latinx migrant family or an Asian migrant family sheltering in place. What else we've seen is the targeting and the demonization of Representative Ilhan Omar, which has been happening for some time. I don't know if you all are aware, but yesterday at a town hall, as Ilhan is stopping a little bit of funding, the abolition of ICE, talking about the need to impeach Kristi Noem, a white man rushes up to her and sprays her with some sort of substance in a syringe. The threat of violence is real. And what makes what's happening here so special is that so many of us are exemplifying a fearlessness that it has become infectious, and more people are saying enough is enough. We will not be made the example by the administration, we will be made the model for the rest of the country. So for me, when I'm thinking about the STOP framework, I'm not looking at this as a narrative framework. I'm looking at this as a call to bring more people in. Bovino left, and the very next day, ICE went harder than ever, not just in Minneapolis and not just in St. Paul, but in suburbs in greater Minnesota. It's not done. People are tired and exhausted. And it is up to everybody on this call, no matter where you live. We need everyday people connecting and driving the demands. We need youth driving the demands, such as Somali and Eritrean and Black youth in colleges deciding that we're going to make the call for us to escalate after Alex Pretty was killed, and we want to have another strike on Friday. We all must be courageous. There is no exceptional thing that we have here that other people don't. But it's going to take inconvenience, courage, and discomfort across all of us to come together, to push the freaking beef aside, and to advance the defense of our countries, of our communities, for the betterment of everyone. 3,000 troops in such a small place is not an accident. And they're not leaving anytime soon. So let's come together. Let's be put into action and be mobilized through this framework to revive the call for more people to come on board. I know I'm over time, my bad. But if anybody's down with that, if anybody wants to go outside, if anybody wants to do mutual aid, if anybody wants to connect with their neighbors, drop it in the chat. Thank you.
Now we're going to move into how the STOP framework is really part of a broader world, right? Part of the militarization internationally, how this is being funded. And I'm going to pass it to our good comrade, Laura, who is the executive director for AB Resource and Organizing, and also part of our comrades over at the Rising Majority. Laura, take it away.
Thank you so much. It's really an honor to be here with you all today. I think by now we all know that our freedom is bound together and absolutely no one is safe while an entire peoples are made expendable. As a Palestinian, I understand this well and understand our struggle as part of a long history of resistance to colonial violence, resistance against the dispossession of indigenous people on Turtle Island, but also resistance to the enslavement of Black people in the US. And that resistance fuels and is fueled by a vision of social and economic justice, a path laid by the Black freedom struggle and carried forward by the land back movement. And today it's being sharpened with the fight against fascism. And I hope that today we all understand something else with some painful clarity, that in order to resist fascism, we have to resist US state violence, both at home and abroad. Everything a majority of people in this country want and deserve is being attacked and denied. Healthcare, education, dignity at work, right relationship to land and the environment and the world. And meanwhile, our tax dollars supply weapons and ammunition to the apartheid state of Israel, undermine sovereign states in Latin America, and support other human rights violating regimes across the world. Because the same forces that bomb Gaza are the ones funding militarization, stoking white supremacy, and undermining democracy in our communities. Military force and coercion are used again and again to impose political outcomes and secure access to vital resources with absolutely little regard for sovereignty or human life. And every time that violence is normalized abroad, it becomes easier to justify here. And that's not accidental. It's the system working exactly as it was designed to do, to take from working people and funnel it into war, surveillance, policing, and repression. And that is why the fight against fascism and the fight against war are two sides of the same coin. In all of these circumstances, the goal is not merely conquest, it's control. From Gaza to Venezuela, new colonial forms of governance are being imposed on people already reeling from violence, sanctions, blockades, and engineered impoverishment. That same precarity, that same resource extraction and repression shows up here in the US, planned and executed by the very same people with the same goals in mind. Systems of power want us divided. They want us disorganized, they want us disenfranchised, and they want us despairing. These are the conditions under which their projects of extraction and pacification thrive. But let's remember that the rise of right-wing authoritarianism isn't some unstoppable force of nature. It's backlash. It's a direct response to the gains won by our movements, like those won by Black communities in Minnesota. It's the agenda of an extreme minority that cannot sustain a real popular mandate. So it relies on violence. It relies on criminalization and surveillance and repression that spreads across our towns and cities, targeting communities and the organizations that defend them. But people keep showing up. People keep showing us that something else is possible, the power of solidarity. Our communities in Minnesota, facing some of the most brutal repression, have refused to disappear. They have organized anyway. They have inspired millions. They remind us that even the most entrenched systems of domination can be challenged when people move together. And just as this brutal system has roots in the exploitation of Black communities, it also carries within it the seeds of its undoing, the centuries-long emancipatory vision of those same people. Our task is to build that kind of solidarity that can finally make those visions real. And that's why organizing to stop ICE in our communities today is not optional. It is a duty. And sanctuary cannot be a symbol or a press release. Sanctuary means abolishing ICE. And that means ICE is not welcome in our businesses. ICE is not welcome in our hotels. ICE is not welcome in our streets. And ICE is not welcome in our schools. It means absolutely no quiet cooperation, no open doors, no just doing my job. It means we make it clear in practice that our neighbors are not up for grabs. And here's the part they want us to not want us to know, right? They don't want us to know that solidarity actually works. When communities refuse raids, when workers disrupt the supply chains of repression, when students walk out, when cities become ungovernable for those who would govern through fear, when labor unions, community organizations, and ordinary people link arms and say, you don't get to disappear our neighbors, you don't get to bomb in our name, and you don't get to build your power on our silence. That is when we win. So today, we are inviting you into that pledge, into this campaign, not as a spectator, but as a commitment. Thank you.
Those were excerpts from a webinar held this week to launch the framework Stop Taking Our People, or STOP for short, and the call to break the ICE machine. And that's our show. I'd like to thank our guests. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, including my dear sister, Margaret Prescott, our board operator, Ozzy Flamenco, and producer, Gary Scott. And I'd like to thank you for your continued support. Let's get together at the same time and place next week for Sojourner Truth Radio. Be well.
Chimurenga. Join us at the Liberated Zone of Freedom Now every Saturday from 11 to noon for a Pan-African perspective on world affairs in a fly music mix. And as always, we stand ready for the revolution.
support comes from the Carpenter Performing Arts Center, presenting MEB, Miles Electric Band, celebrating the Miles Davis Centennial on Friday, January 30th, 2026 at 8 p.m. Featuring Miles Davis alumni and next generation innovators, this all-star ensemble is led by Emmy and Grammy Award-winning producer-drummer Vince Wilburn Jr. and features Miles alumni Daryl Jones.